So we are going to talk about Bossware today. Before we can do that, I have to make a quick disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by each speaker in this talk are the opinions of the respective speaker. This is important to state because our employer has allowed us to perform some of the underlying research during work time on the clock. However, it is important to mention that we do not speak for our employer here today. We prepared the presentation ourselves, and these are our opinions. When I say we, I want to show you the team that is behind this. We have, first of all, our colleague Daniel Hirschberger, who is not here today at GPN, but made the same amount of effort in the research. We have Tobias Niemann, who is also not at GPN. But then we have myself, Marius Renner, and we have Nicole over here. And as I mentioned, we performed some of this work during during work hours for our employer, SecConsult, and their Vulnerability Lab program. Our goals with this project were to, first of all, find some interesting vulnerabilities, maybe get a few blog posts out of it while we're at it, and we wanted to expose the shadiness of Bossware and the process, which I'm going to show you a little bit later. And most importantly, we wanted to have fun while doing all of these things, and as we say in German, we wanted to have Spaß am Gerät. We had 1 week to do this. We had 4 people, so 20 person days. We work in consulting, so we count everything in person days. And this is this might sound like a lot, but we looked at many different software products, so it came out to be 1 to 2 days for each software product we looked at. And because of this time restriction, and also because this was performed on our own initiative and that went not because some of the Bossware vendors asked us to do it, we had some restrictions on methodology. First of all, we could only hack software we can install on our own machines, or virtual machines in this case, and we could not attack any cloud products of the Bossware vendors because we didn't want to get into any legal hot water. So of course, we can't just send weird HTTP requests to Bossware vendor servers. We could only look at the stuff running on our own machines. But with that being said, we can look at the local agent software that is used to spy on the employees as they are working. As that piece of software is running on the local machine, we just have to be careful not to send any altered requests to the server and just look at the agent. Because of the time restriction, we wanted free trials only. We didn't want to contact sales to get a demo version installed. And we also knew from past experiences of other colleagues doing projects like these that software vendors are very reluctant to give demo versions to security consulting companies that want to find vulnerabilities in their software, which is a bit weird if you think about it. I mean, we're literally offering free work, but I guess they don't see it like it. They see it like we are just shoving work onto them when we want to disclose vulnerabilities. But yeah, maybe there are some education to do there. And because of the time restriction, again, we didn't have time for lengthy setup processes. So some of the products required setting up multiple servers and VM appliances and stuff like that. And if it didn't work after like 2 hours, we didn't have time for that. So we just chose another product. So the software we were looking at is not a representative sample. The sample is restricted by these methodology requirements. So don't take it as a comprehensive analysis, but just as an opinionated and opportunistic snapshot. Okay. Now I want to explain what Bossware actually is. And as we already heard in the introduction, Bossware is used to look at what employees at a company are doing when they are on the clock in an effort to, quote unquote, boost productivity and, I don't know, out slackers at work or something like that. That's the, I guess, neutral description, but if you ask me, it is a surveillance capitalism nightmare, and I do not like it. But maybe I'm a bit biased, so let's look at the marketing these companies put out. Maybe it's not actually that bad, maybe I'm just, I don't know, sensitive. And first of all, we have Controlio. Also, the names of these products are just amazing. They are all just permutations of control, work, examine, monitor, and all of these nice words. And we will later have one vendor name which we can't disclose yet, but there's no real risk of me accidentally mentioning it because I can't tell these apart. They all sound the same. But anyway, Controlio offers a nice productivity score for your employees. In the year 2026, it's AI powered, of course. I don't know what AI is doing here, but it might exist. And it tries to track productive and distractive activities. And that's a common theme for all of these. That might sound a bit reasonable, I guess, maybe. But then you have stuff like user behavior rules, which alert when users open specific applications or access specific websites, or might alert on the frequency of keystrokes or on the content of these keystrokes. Yes, there are keyloggers in this kind of software. They also monitor USB devices, active and idle periods, stuff like that. And it's not just Controlio, we also have DeskTime here. DeskTime does time tracking, performance evaluation, reports, scheduling, and quote unquote extra features. What kind of extra features might that be? Well, for example, screenshots. You can just configure DeskTime to take a screenshot every minute, every 2 minutes, every 5 minutes of your employee's screens, so you can later spy on them and see what they were doing. Yeah. Then we have the gradually more shady companies. We have iMonitorSoft, in my opinion shady, it's my personal opinion. And without reading all of that, they say, and I quote, I did not change the grammar here, recording every employee computer activities include keystrokes, clipboard activities, screenshots, files, documents, print jobs, email, and so on and so on. So they basically want to capture everything and want to offer that to the company that the employees are working for. We have varying degrees of creepiness here. So DeskTime is one of the better ones, I guess, where you can configure it to, first of all, blur the screenshots. Let's not get into the fact that blurring images might not be the best way to keep information private, but anyway. It also offers the option to enable the so-called private time option, which allows employees to specifically say, okay, don't take screenshots of whatever I'm doing now. Maybe the employees are actually allowed to do some private internet surfing on the job, but then they have to specifically enable it that they are not being tracked. This implies that they know that they are being tracked in this case, and that's the good case. We also have Controlio offering a stealth mode where they offer that the client agent program is completely invisible to the user, no icons on the taskbar or processes in task manager. I'm not sure if they're actually fully hiding the process in task manager. I don't think this one had a weird driver doing stuff like that, but it's in shady territory. And with all of that, I ask myself if there were ethical considerations before we wanted to propose this project. When I started thinking about that, I was thinking what the risks were and what the possible upsides could be. We had some requirements, again, because this was performed on the clock. We had to adhere to the guidelines our vulnerability lab has for these cases, and these guidelines apply to all public disclosures. I think that's because they want to reduce legal liability. If they single someone out, then you get into weird competition legal stuff in Germany, I guess. So we have to do coordinated disclosure. We cannot just say, oh, we don't like you, we do full disclosure. And also, in case any bug bounties are paid, which we are not trying to get, but if the companies are offering bug bounty money, it will not go to us, it will not go to the company, but it will be donated. This is to remove any conflicts of interests or alleged conflicts of interests. If you are doing this on your private time, I don't think it's that much of an issue, but if you are doing it from a company, you might again get into hot water with that. And with that, I ask myself, do we want to provide free work to these companies? Aren't we helping shady people doing shady things? And I thought a bit about that and came to the conclusion that there are more possible upsides than downsides. Yes, we might provide, if we divide it by the number of products we look at, 1 or 2 days of work to each of these vendors. But then again, if the vulnerabilities are something we can find in 1 or 2 days, it's probably obvious. And if the stuff is going to be a little bit more difficult to find, we aren't going to find it in 1 or 2 days. So it's not like we're handing them something extremely valuable. And on the other hand, we have to think about who the possible victims of security vulnerabilities in this product, in these products are. And these are not the bossware vendors. I don't think they care they don't care, I think. But we have the companies who are using the bossware, and the data of the company might be at risk. The software might also contain private and personal data of the employees, because they might not know that they are being tracked. They might not know that there's a keylogger on their computer and a thing taking screenshots every minute. So they might have used their work computer to quickly log into their banking account or something, or quickly log into, I don't know, their dating profile, I don't know. And they don't want this stuff out there. They don't want any malicious actors compromising the bossware server and taking all of that data out of there. And it also might affect normal people in the general public who are not even employees of these kind of companies, but are just customers of companies using bossware. Imagine the worst case scenario. You have to do age verification stuff, and the age verification company needs to have a huge office building of workers doing ID verification. And now imagine that there's bossware running on these computers, taking screenshots of your private documents, and then you have a huge treasure trove of personal documents somewhere as screenshots. And if that stuff gets leaked, then the people who have nothing to do with this software or bossware are going to feel the consequences. And the potential upsides, I think, are to just raise awareness and make people aware that this kind of software exists. And my personal hope is, although I'm not sure if that works, but I'll try anyway, that information security officers of companies or CEOs of companies who might be playing with the thought of introducing something like this, maybe we can just tell them that it's a bad idea for security reasons as well as the ethical reasons. And maybe one more reason to not do it pushes them to not implement bossware. And because of all these things, I think it is ethically acceptable to do this research and to do coordinated disclosure without doing too much harm. All right, with that out of the way, I'm going to let Nicole start with the security considerations.
Security considerations. So why are those interesting? First of all, we have the ethical concerns, but if we're honest, most probably won't just care about them when implementing bossware in their company. It's just what it is. Then there's the question, is it effective to use bossware? And look at your processes. There's been worse in the company. If things were effective, you'd be doing stuff differently most of the time. And that's not really a reason not to implement bossware if it seems nice. But there's still security, right? And security is where it gets interesting, because security has an impact financially. If the company gets compromised, as a CEO, you don't really want to have your whole company network encrypted and pay some bitcoins to get it decrypted. And there's also legal issues. So lawyers are famously expensive, and if you can avoid needing one, that's amazing. So that's why we look at the security considerations. And regarding the security considerations, I also brought an overview of Clever Control. And there's some nice features listed. As you can see, keylogger, screenshots, removable storage devices, those are some of the functions that bossware offers. Nice C2 software you got there. Would be a shame if someone, you know, break it, do stuff with it. So what are the kinds of vulnerabilities we looked for? It was mostly focused on local privilege escalation, preferably getting access as anti-authority or system. It was a goal to obtain unauthorized access to capture data. This could be keylogger data, this could be screenshots, it could be anything the software might record it. And of course, remote code execution, for example, abusing updater functionality as a man in the middle, or abusing other remote access capabilities to gain access to the machine and further exploit anything. So here's an overview of some of the software that we looked at. Some of those already got mentioned, and we decided to just take a stick, poke it, see what it does, and if we can maybe find something interesting in there. So the first one to start with is Controlio, and this is the first vulnerability we're going to talk about. So Controlio has a folder where some DLLs are located, and those DLLs contain various functionality. They're loaded into the program when the program is executed. And the nice thing is we got world writable installation directory. And that means we can basically just change the content of the DLL, updated it, and gain access as anti-authority. So that's the first pawn, I would say. And for disclosing this, we have a very interesting timeline. So there's the initial notification, and then 1 month later, the reminder, we found something, how's it going? Is there anything? No response. And then 1 month later, we decided, let's try submitting it via a support ticket. And the vendor, 1 month later, accepted the vulnerability, granted $250 bug bounty reward. As we already mentioned, we don't take bug bounty rewards, so we asked the bug bounty money to be donated instead. And 1 month after that, we heard a fixes on the roadmap delayed due to internal overload. The donation is confirmed though, and then once again a few months later, the build is on hold because there are some driver issues with our software that needs to be addressed, and even later, 2 months later, the vulnerability is finally fixed. We still don't know what the driver issues are about because this functionality is unrelated to the drivers, but I guess if that's what it takes. So that's our first pawn software. Let's look at the next one. The next one is desk time, and we have the update check. And the update check uses TLS certificates, because if you want to update software, you want to make sure it's a secure connection, you want to make sure that whatever you are downloading is actually the thing you want to download. But let's maybe change the validation logic in our software. I'm pretty sure nothing could go wrong with that. So let's just use this code here and have some interesting compares and functionality. And if you take a look closer, SSL policy errors enum is very interesting because we have various conditions for it to accept the TLS certificate check and various conditions to reject it. It's, for example, accepted when there is no SSL policy errors. It is accepted when Oh, that's interesting, when it has returned a non-empty array. So if the server name matches, that's good enough for us. Who needs a valid chain of trust anyway, right? Like, the whole point of TLS, we just make sure the name is right. So obviously, we can just man in the middle of that and issue our own certificate, change some stuff, we don't need the full chain, and then we can give a custom updater, and that updater can then do code execution because the updated program is just what we inserted as man in the middle. Classical calculator spawn in this example. So I would say that's the next one that spawned. Very interesting. Next one, iMonitorSoft.
Yes, and for iMonitorSoft, I have a nice screenshot for you. So I don't know if this is big enough, but this is the admin dashboard of iMonitorSoft, and in the central area of the screen, you can see the live desktop view of my demo machine in which I'm actually currently analyzing the traffic in Wireshark. More about that later. But you have a very nice toolbar in there, which has interesting functions. You have, let's see if I can do this. You have live desktop access, you have remote desktop access, so you can just control the machine while the employee is working on it. If the employee is fighting back, you can also lock the screen on their side, so their mouse and keyboard inputs are not working anymore. You can also turn off the screen on their side, so this saver on, saver off enables or disables a black screen overlay by some privileged process, so the employee doesn't even know what's happening. You also have remote camera access, which I somehow find even more creepy than the remote desktop access. You have a file explorer to look at the data stored on the computer. You can also drop some new data on there or remove some data. You have the option to send a command to execute on every machine. You can do this for one machine. You can do this for your whole fleet. It's really convenient. You can restart the computer, shut off the computer. You can look at the running processes, at the active network connections, the applications that are running. It's a great software. I mean, if this was, I don't know, a commercial command and control framework, it might actually get some traction. And I just found this abhorrent. When I see this, it I don't know, it's just insulting to every employee working somewhere. But anyway, I have already spoiled the Wireshark instance on my screen. So we took the good old Shark and looked at the traffic, and well, we got plain text, and and in this case, again, you can see that I was playing around with Wireshark on the machine that was being monitored, so you can see some of my Wireshark filters as I clumsily configured them, but you can also see a password, a decoy password that I entered into, I think it was MS Edge in this case, because it was just a throwaway Windows VM, and as you can see, all the passwords and every single keyboard input is going in there, and it's just transmitted in plain text. So if you just listen to the data as it's going over the wire, you can just get all kinds of interesting stuff. I don't know in what century they did this, but it's just terrible. But we can again thank the Wireshark for this vulnerability. I think it speaks for itself, I think. Then we have a recurring theme here. We're looking at the auto updater again. Side note here, we work as pen testers, and whenever we are looking at desktop applications, auto updaters are broken around, I don't know, 80% of the time. I haven't done the statistics, but they are always broken. For some reason, most vendors are allergic to just leaving the TLS logic alone. You literally have to not do something, and it's secure. If you do anything to it, it's most likely broken, but they just can't resist. In this case, it's not TLS though. In this case, I don't actually know how the update logic works because I didn't have too much time. I just know that it has a local part where the new executables are stored in the directory C sysupdate. And of course, this directory is world writable because why wouldn't it be? And we have EMUSB server 64 that runs as system because it has to do some USB fuckery. And you just drop any DLL used by the EMUSB server into C sysupdate, and then you have to do something special. You have to drop the finish.txt file, which is used to actually start the update process, some kind of marker to tell the software that you are done writing the update files. And then it overrides its own installation directory, and you can get system this way, of course. Yeah, then we have default credentials. And not any kind of default credential. We have admin and then 3 digits. You might think that's bad enough. These 3 digits are also displayed on the login screen of the admin interface to remind you if you forget. And with that, you don't just get demo access, it's just full access to the admin console. You don't get any prompt to change the password. You just get access, and I wouldn't be too sure that most companies using this are changing the password. Yeah. But even if they are, just remember this stuff is going over the wire in plain text. So if you want the password later, you can just get it. believe it or not, I think the disclosure timeline is even more fun for this one. We told them, we sent them a message, hey, we have some vulnerabilities in your product, and for our vulnerability lab, the process is always that we tell them, we don't give them the vulnerability itself because we want to be good citizens and we want them to offer us an encrypted mailbox or something so we can send it over nice and encrypted. Most companies don't do that. We can also send it over unencrypted, but we don't want to do it unprompted, because if we just send it to support at, it might get into a ticket system where thousands of support employees have access. So we just ask them, hey, we have something, do you want it? No response. We ask them again 2 weeks later, no response. So our colleague tries the online support chat and tells them, hey, we tried to reach you, you didn't respond, we have found some security vulnerabilities in your products, can you please tell us anyone who's responsible, we want to contact, best regards. And they say, hello, do you have any questions regarding our software? Mind you, this is the same chat, right? And it's just 10 minutes later. It's in the chat what we want. And at this point, our colleague is a little bit irritated and says, no, we don't have any questions regarding your software. We have identified high-risk security issues, and we want to talk to somebody. And you know what they did and responded? No further comment, I think. Yeah, so we just did the disclosure on our website because the vendor was unresponsive.
Enjoy the 0 day.
Yeah, if these don't work anymore for any reason, I'm sure you can find more. Yeah, so with that, I think we can say iMonitorSoft is also pwned. Let's look at Clever Control next, and they have a new twist for us. They also do software updates, but in this case, they use curl, because curl doesn't fuck with certificate handling and actually does it properly. Now, what would be the one thing you should not put in this gap if you want this to be secure? What would be the one thing? Maybe it would be the flag --- insecure. It's so funny that they didn't even use -k, the short option where you don't see what it might be doing. They actually used the long option --- insecure to do this. I can't fathom why, but yeah. And of course, you can just again do man-in-the-middle attack to remote code execution. We have already heard about that a few times. And of course, when we tried to disclose this, we got no vendor response. Yeah, so this was Clever Control then. We have WorkTime next, and WorkTime has, like most of these applications, it has a server component and a client component. You install the server component somewhere on your network, and the server component has an API to download the desktop agents for the employees you want to monitor. And this download has a UID parameter, so you can track which users downloaded your monitoring software, so you can properly do an inventory of all your machines and can track if every employee clicked on it when you want them to install it themselves. I don't know. Written in PHP, nice side note. But not that relevant here, because you can just do a command injection into the UID, and then you get code execution on the server because it does some weird stuff using shell commands. I think this was on Windows, so batch commands probably, to construct the download package with the UID in there. So you get remote code execution on the server. Might sound bad enough, but of course the server is running as NT authority system, because why wouldn't it? Yeah, so we get system on the server. And with that, we get all of the data, right? So now we have the server owned, we can look at everything. We also have a vulnerability that we nicknamed the big red button. The server has an error page for database errors. We didn't trigger it normally, it just is a static error page. It's called DB error, and it's used if there are any errors connected to the database. And if you just visit it, as it is a static page, you get the error page, nothing special here. And this error page has a button to click. And you know what you might want to do if your software can't reach the database? Yeah, you might want to reset the database configuration to make it work again. So we just do a post request unauthenticated to db:error/reset, and the database configuration is erased, and the application doesn't work anymore. This is just a denial of service. The database contents are not deleted. It's just the connection string and username and password stuff. So you can fix it later and make it work again. But I think it's quite interesting that you can do this. And yeah, if you pass it, the server just goes, no database and me no worky anymore. We also have some other vulnerabilities. We don't have the time to go too deep into it, but and also we already had remote code execution on the server as system, so why do weird stuff like SQL injection? Why bother with cross-site scripting? And you know what? Let's throw in another word, writable auto-update path for good measure. At this point, we are not even surprised anymore. The disclosure timeline for this one is also interesting. We tell them about it in July of 2025. The vendor actually answers, which is already great, and they receive our advisory. 2 months later, we ask for a status update, and the vendor just tells us, well, we are secure now, we resolved a CVE, CVE 2025, whatever, Firebird for on-premises. At this point, we hadn't reserved a CVE yet, I think. At least we didn't tell them. And they tell us it's fixed now. We tell them, that's great, you fixed something. It doesn't have anything to do with our findings, though. I think a poor support person, just pattern matched on CVE and just sent something over. So 2 months later, we got a bit busy. We asked them for a status update. They say, we will get back to you within a week. That did not happen. So we just announce our public disclosure date to them and say, hey, if you want to do something about this, tell us. No response, we publish. All right, so with that, I think work time can also be considered pwned. And now Nicole will tell you more about Work Examiner and the last one, the spicy one.
So Work Examiner, we got something interesting going on here. So we have an FTP server because that's obviously the best way to store the client logs and make sure that everyone submits the data that's needed. And what could be nicer than to make sure that the connection works by just using hard-coded credentials? So we look at the application, we find hard-coded credentials, and we connect to the FTP server, we list the files, it works, so obviously it's the correct credentials. That's already nice, but given that we can rename and overwrite the service binaries, we can also gain code execution. So once again, code execution through the hard-coded credentials, that's good. But the even better part is there's a Windows firewall exception set for the FTP server, so the logs, aka keylogger logs or whatever, can be properly uploaded. And conveniently, this allows to once again get anti-authority system. There's also some other interesting stuff going on there. So we have a very nice function here, and we want to use that one for checks. And the idea is to hash the password and to compare the hash to make sure everything's secure and nice. And then we just let the client validate the result. That might not be the best idea. So there's a client validation for it, and there's this nice little bit here, and if there's by some cosmic chance a bit flip happening somehow, that would be a shame, because that would allow us to basically just log in and access the admin panel. Or we could just patch it. And by just patching it, you just gain access to everything you want access to, which is pretty nice. And then there's also the monitoring client that transmits the data to the FTP server unencryptedly, of course. So we already had our fun with our little shonky, and we can just once again man in the middle it. And because that's not already nice enough, we have the same for the admin console, because why not? I think at this point we can just say we're basically done. So the next one, we can't really talk about which one that is yet. It's still being published. And we have an installation directory where the binaries are installed and all the files for that software. And we thought, why not just decompile it? There's been some .NET files in there. Maybe there's something interesting in there. Can't be too bad. Maybe some hard-coded credentials or whatever. And we took a look at it, and there's been some AWS credentials in there. Which is really nice, because we have the access key, we have the secret key, we have the bucket names, we have the region, we have basically everything we need to have some fun. And of course, we think that's so bad, no one would do that. So maybe we should just verify this and try some command to get the caller identity. And oh, that's nice. We have root access. That's cool. But I'm pretty certain it's not in use anymore. So maybe we can list some buckets and inspect the instance and just try to copy one of the screenshots that's been taken some time ago. And oh, it's working. So basically at this point, we have full access to their EC2 machines, to their buckets, and all user data and all billing information. And their software releases, which is nice. So, I mean, we could have just patched it at this point, I guess, and published a new release. Well, so timeline-wise, we contacted, we reached out, we heard there's a new version, we can do a mitigation check, we fixed it, can you take a look at it? So, of course, the old credentials have been revoked, that's good, they don't work for us anymore. There's a new suspicious string that's retrieved from the API after we log in, and it seems like the string is encrypted. So what's the algorithm, what's the key? It's like a little CTF crypto challenge, and it's triple death. That's nice. And the key is hard-coded. That's even better. So we're done again, I guess. And we still have the other credentials. So we have one credential that is up to date and one with lower access rights. And it's basically the same point where we've been before the disclosure. So we try it again. There's a new version. We do a quick mitigation check. And the client sends now a new parameter to the server. And the API no longer responds with the encrypted credentials. That seems promising. That's good. So we omit the parameter from the request, because web pen testing, maybe something funny happens. It's the same behavior as before. Maybe it's finally fixed now, though. I think we should check again. The vendor asks us, I guess this will take some time to figure out. So it's still in process of being disclosed. It's taking its sweet time, because every time we look at it, something else falls out of it. At some point, it will be disclosed. I think at this point, we can also say the software got pawned. And we poked all of our software with a stick, and everything is on fire, everything is broken, everything is, we don't even know. And there's been some nice CVEs coming out of that. So from this 1 week, our results are that we got 15 vulnerabilities out of it and multiple unresponsive vendors. If you want to see the details, check the publications in the vulnerability lab. We published 6 blog posts and 1 blog post that isn't published yet with the redacted vendor. So that's a pretty good result for 1 week of poking stuff with a stick, I would say. And brings us to our conclusion. Bossware is a terrible idea for many reasons, including security. And we can basically say that most vendors reacted kind of in this way. Either they were sorry and fixed it, and sometimes it was a fix, sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes they didn't really seem to care. There's basically, if you look up the advisories, 2 ways of exploiting software that are currently out there, because the vendor didn't bother to react to our outreach attempts. So don't use Bossware.
All right. And with that, I think we're done. Again, I want to shout out some huge thanks to Daniel Hirschberger and Tobias Niemann, who helped us with this research. They also did 5 days each and helped with the disclosure stuff, but they are not here today. So yeah, we also wanted to thank them again. All right.
Okay, I definitely took the best talk to Harold today. Okay, so great talk. Now we get to the question and answer part. You do the questioning. They, hopefully, probably, do the answering. So can I see some hands? I know they work. Okay.
So how many programs did you test without finding something?
I think I looked at one more product which I couldn't get to run in a reasonable amount of time, and when I finally got it to run, I had like half a day left, and I didn't find anything in that half day. So for me it's one. I don't know if you have any more information about that, but I think for most of the products we found something.
I think I had the AWS finding and some other fun stuff, so everything I looked at was pretty broken.
Yeah.
So. I think the others also, there's been like maybe one or two, but most of them were vulnerable. It's also like if you find vulnerable software, you spend more time poking around and preparing the advisory and everything. So if there's nothing to find, we probably also moved on to another target where it was more promising to find some good stuff.
Yeah, I think there were two cases of this now that I thought about it. But again, we have some selection bias here, so take that with a grain of salt.
For the software desk time, can you give a little more detail how you actually circumvented the proper check of the certificate chain?
Mm-hmm. We didn't circumvent it. Desk time did. give me a second. You're talking about this, I think. This code is in the desk time client. So the desk time client takes the server certificate validation callback. By the way, if you just don't do anything to that, it works and it's secure. But what they did is they said, okay, we accept remote certificates if there are either no errors, or then there are two conditions that don't matter because they're basically true all the time anyway, or they also accept it if there are chain errors. And the only other things in the enum are that the names do not match. So chain errors just get accepted. You only have to provide a certificate with the correct name. The chain of trust doesn't matter. So we didn't circumvent it, desk time did.
The only part we had to do is issue a certificate and act as a man in the middle attacker.
Yes, but you can just, I don't know, take burp and let it do it, let it do what it does, and it works.
Yeah. Hi, thank you for the really great talk. Concerning the companies, from which countries were the software? Mm-hmm. Are they European companies? And if it's used in Europe, from your knowledge, what is the implication according to the data privacy law?
I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty sure that in most of Europe it would be flat out illegal to use stuff like this. Maybe you can make some edge cases for high assurance stuff where you always need to have two people to do something, but then you must tell that you must tell your employees that you are doing this. But even then, I think it would probably be illegal in Europe. The companies are from varying origins. So the more shady stuff was, I think, somewhere from Eastern Europe, and some companies are in the Southeast Asian part of the world. But I don't have the material ready to confidently answer that, so I won't do it, sorry.
If I recall correctly, there's also been some very interesting connections in some of the companies. So some companies, when we tried to contact them, we looked them up, and it seemed like some were owned by some Chinese parent company and were operating in the United States, which was very interesting to see. So if you look at the imprint on the webpage and you check the company details in any website that offers such services, then you will most likely find something interesting. It's either something like that or some shady place where data privacy is not taken too seriously. So it's usually the origin. I think the story in detail can be told much better by the one that did the research on one of those companies and found those connections, but we didn't include it in the talk due to the length of that.
You said that that you contacted most companies first through a proper way and then through support, for example. What was the proper way? Because I don't assume they have a security TXT on their app server like
no,
they should have.
They don't. We tried email first because we thought email, we might have a chance to let's say it like this. The email will go to some poor first-level support person, and they won't know what to do with it. And our thought was that if we do it by email, they can forward it internally. If we do stuff like support chat, they are under pressure to reply now. And that's why we thought email would be the better way and might actually yield something. And then if we get more frustrated and if that doesn't work, we try stuff like reaching out via support chats, live chats. Sometimes we try to stalk the employees of the companies on LinkedIn and ping them and try to find someone.
We actually did that, yes.
But in this case, as Nicole already said, some of these companies have obscured where their developers actually work, and it was difficult to find someone. But we do a reasonable effort to try and find somebody, but yeah, if they don't respond to multiple ways of contact, then I guess they don't want it.
There's also a policy of the VulnApp on the website, how we disclose, and for email, you also have the nice bonus that you have track record of when you reached out and what information has been provided at which point in time, which is helpful if you want to like get into the legal stuff with the legal team.
Yeah.
So you mentioned these two vulnerabilities about TLS validation. Would it be a plausible explanation that they are breaking their TLS checks because companies that use this kind of software would also do like transparent proxying with their own TrustRoot installed on these machines, or would the curl and the .NET, I guess, code just honor the TrustRoot usually?
I think you are assuming too much professionalism here. I think if you are proxying all your machines through some proxy to inspect the traffic, then you are actually competent enough to install the certificate on the local machines, and you don't need to break your TLS to do that. I think the reason is, if you ask me, I don't know for sure, but I think it's just to make the installation easier because you don't have to configure certificates. Because as the vendor, they just provide the download, you install the stuff on premises, and then your customer, the company using the bossware and implementing it, has to then create a certificate valid in their network, and they think they just want to make the installation just work, but of course you just can't do that and make it secure at the same time.
It might also be due to the test environment and development process. Maybe it's been easier for the development to just exclude it and they just didn't put it back in.
Yeah.
In one of the softwares you showed, you said you could escalate to anti-authority from a firewall rule. Could you elaborate on that?
That was related to the FTP. Let me find the slide.
The firewall rule makes sure that the communication is possible to the outside, and the authority is because of how the FTP server runs.
Yeah, the FTP server either runs as system or has write access to the installation directory of the system service. And we just wanted to make sure to mention that the firewall rule for the FTP server is also being created by the installer. So it's not something you have to do deliberately. It's just broken by default.
Okay, do I see any more hands? No, not for now. Then I'm going to take my privilege as Harold and going to ask, did you find out in your research any companies that used those softwares? Like, for example, any ID check companies that have like offices in Southeast Asia that use those software, which my data might be in?
No, because when my colleagues told me about the AWS stuff, for example, I got really scared. I didn't want to be the person downloading a whole AWS bucket and then the police comes and takes all of my hardware. So we downloaded one screenshot, and we downloaded the screenshot. We had to set up a whole environment where we had to capture the name of the screenshot of our machine that was being transmitted to the server. So we got the file name in the bucket, and then we used the root credentials to download our own screenshot. And that's the one screenshot we downloaded. We could have found out who uses this kind of stuff, but we would not be allowed to.
I can also say that it got really interesting when you have the credentials and you see like the bucket lists and you see production data going back to like 2006, and they promise to like delete stuff somewhere, and obviously they don't, and there's like log files and user data and all of that. Then you want to be really careful which parts you touch and which parts you don't touch.
Yeah, we did a directory listing, for example, on the invoices bucket because we wanted to see if it was empty, because surely it's empty, right? And we got this huge list of invoice documents and we decided to definitely not download any of that.
Okay, as I don't see any more questions, and I know I heard all of you laughing at least once, give them a warm round of applause for their great talk again.